Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where long-term performance is driven by original, fundamental research on a global scale. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
It's still up in the air as to whether banking or real estate is going to lead the recovery, but Wells Fargo made a pretty good case for financials today. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Fund, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is the 9th of April, Thursday. Good to have you here. And I can sum up today's stock market rally for you in just two words, Wells and Fargo. The San Francisco-based bank said this morning that when it officially reports first quarter earnings next week, it is going to be a doozy, $3 billion in profit. The announcement came as the health of the nation's big banks. Wells Fargo is number four on that list, by the way. It remains the topic of much speculation. How bad are their bad assets? How much more bailing out might it take to make them healthy? And for Wells Fargo, where the heck did they get all that money? Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson reports now from New York.
You can't talk about Wells Fargo without talking about Wachovia. Wells bought Wachovia late last year and picked up its extensive base of East Coast bank branches and consumer deposits. Celent banking analyst Barton Arter says all that consumer cash in low-interest accounts is coming in very handy.
They've got a lot of deposits. A lot of those deposits are very low cost, and they can lend out those deposits and make a very nice interest spread.
Wells is lending out the money in part for new mortgages. Banking expert Nancy Bush at NAB Research says the first quarter results also include a flood of big business deals, deals that had idled in frozen credit markets in the fourth quarter. But Bush says
the capital markets riches that are getting pushed into the first quarter may not persist through the rest of the year, and I think it's unlikely that they'll persist into the rest of the year.
There's another thing Wells watchers say is helping right now. When Wells bought Wachovia, it marked down the toxic assets on Wachovia's balance sheet, and many of its own as well. So, as Celent's Barton Arter says,
they've taken their medicine and now they're moving forward.
But it's not clear the rest of the nation's big banks are moving forward with them. Matthew Warren manages the bank research team at Morningstar.
Watch for Bank of America and Citigroup's earnings. Those are some of the bigger banks that have more troubles and trickier exposures. So if you want to make judgments about the broader system, I'd wait and see how that shakes out.
In fact, analysts say Wells Fargo has benefited from uncertainty about its competition as more and more consumers opt for the safety of that old stagecoach. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
The news from Wells Fargo today comes as government regulators are wrapping up their survey of the banking sector. Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner calls them stress tests. For the past couple of months, federal bank examiners have been running 19 big institutions through computer simulations, how they would do if the economy contracts even more and stays down longer than expected. What if unemployment hits double digits over the next year, or if home prices fall another 20%? President Obama will be briefed on the results and what he should do with them tomorrow. Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports now from Washington.
The banks can't fail these tests, but if they break under the virtual stress, regulators can require more capital reserves or changes in management or business strategy. The FDIC, which tests bank assets all the time, issued a statement today saying the stress assessments are necessary to assure regulators that banks are strong enough to weather the economic storm. Regulators aren't allowed to talk about how the tests were conducted or the results, but Chris Lowe, chief economist at FTN Financial in New York, hears the tests have been thorough.
Most of the reports suggest that they were a lot more rigorous than the bankers themselves expected. So I do think they will be treated as effective means of measuring the durability of banks.
The question now is what should be done with the results.
The most important thing from my perspective is that the outcome of the stress test is not destiny.
Barbara Matthews is a former government regulator and now a private consultant. She says good test results will be a magnet for private investors, while bad grades will be just the opposite.
It becomes very tricky, though, doesn't it? Say you're a bank. Hi, my stress test came out really badly. please would you give me money? That's a very difficult sell to a private capital market.
The test results will be good tools for regulators, she says, but communicating them properly to the public without raising concerns in an already frightened market will be a challenge for the administration. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Wells Fargo, Wells Fargo, and Wells Fargo. That's pretty much all you needed to know about Wall Street today. We will have the details when we do the numbers. As Jeremy Hobson alluded to, one of the reasons Wells Fargo is expecting such a bang-up first quarter is that the rules have changed. Last week, the board that gets to decide these things loosened up the rules on what's called mark-to-market. Companies now have more leeway to assign a value to an asset where no market for it exists. Commentator Paul Kedrosky thinks the banks are being allowed to pull a fast one.
Some people have convinced themselves that a cause of the current crisis was the awful, terrible idea of pricing things properly. Heresy, I call it. Price things at a level at which you can sell them on the open market? Where else but in banking would you see such a silly idea? Well, other than in malls, of course, and corner stores, and car dealers. Okay, pretty much everywhere. So why do bankers want their own pricing rules? Good question. First, bankers and their boosters argue that it makes no sense to price things to market when you have no intention of selling them. Okay, but even though I don't plan to sell my Beanie Baby collection right now, I would like to know what they're worth. Banks aren't different. They just like to pretend they are if it keeps them from being taken over by the FDIC. Second, banks say that some markets are distressed, so they can't get proper prices for their wacky paper. Nice. The market for some deranged credit derivative is gone, never to return, so I get to make up a price. Call it mark to myth. Preferably high myths. So, let's summarize. Bankers don't want to price crappy assets that they shouldn't have bought in the first place, so they cross their fingers and say they're going to hold those assets forever. And if you call their bluff and tell them to price the dreck anyway, then recent changes in accounting rules mean they get to say the market is distressed, and so they can make up prices. No thanks. Fibs, funny money, and fake markets are no way to fix banking. And anyone who feels otherwise, well, I have a bunch of $1,000 purple and yellow Beanie Babies waiting for you right here.
Paul Kedrosky is a senior fellow at the Kauffman Foundation. His blog on the economy is called Infectious Greed. Ours is called The Scratch Pad. There are links to both on our homepage. It's marketplace.org. And while you're there, help us out with the project we're working on. Would you send us your favorite published poem about banks or money or the economy or all three? Look for the link that says poetry. Another 650,000 people started collecting unemployment checks last week. Fewer than expected, but still near record highs. One might say, wow, that's a lot of pink slips. But why would you say that? Where did that particular phrase come from? We called somebody who's in a position to know. Jesse Scheidlauer is an editor-at-large of the Oxford English Dictionary. Good to have you with us.
Good to be here. Thank you.
So can you help us out with pink slip and where it came from?
Not entirely, because I'm afraid that no one really knows exactly where it comes from. What most people will say is that, well, people used to get fired from jobs by, you know, getting a notice that was printed on pink paper. And, you know, that sounds obviously completely sensible. The problem is no one has ever found evidence for this actually happening. Historians who have spent a great deal of effort looking into all sorts of records for a literal example of a pink slip being used to fire someone and just have never found them.
Wait a minute. So somebody made it up and it just stuck?
Well, what happens is that we have evidence from around the turn of the last century in a number of different contexts where a pink slip is something critical in various ways. So the very earliest example we have is where a pink slip is a note sent to a typographer indicating that he's made a mistake, and if you got enough of them, then you would be fired. And there's, you know, yet another intermediate one in 1905, where a pink slip is specifically a rejection letter from a magazine. So a writer would submit a story, and it would get a pink slip back, you know, meaning that the story was rejected. So clearly, there's something going on at around this time where pink slip was being used to refer to various kinds of rejection.
Is it an Americanism, or do they have the same thing in, say, the UK or in Russia or India?
No, it is an Americanism. But one of the interesting things about it is that in other countries, they have different colors to refer to dismissal from a job. So in Germany, the expression is to get the blue letter. And in the French military, you would be dismissed with a yellow paper, carte jaune.
Mm-hmm. Well, so it's been 100 or so years since this phrase started. And yet here we find ourselves in an age where people are dismissed by text message and voicemail. Why do you think it stuck around so long?
Well, once the expression sticks, there's no reason for it to go away. I mean, we still talk about dialing a phone, even though phones don't have dials anymore. So, you know, once an expression is established, the ultimate meaning, you know, even if we don't know what it is, doesn't necessarily have any relevance. And people keep using it, even if the original meaning has changed or we've forgotten what it is or if we never knew.
Jesse Scheidlauer, he's an editor-at-large at the Oxford English Dictionary. Mr. Scheidlauer, thanks a lot for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Businesses all over the world are pulling back. They're selling down inventories and cutting costs to help hang on to their money. In Europe, though, there is one group that has cash to burn. Megan Williams reports now from Naples that recession is a growth industry for organized crime.
Salve. 44-year-old Angela is greeted by her lawyer as she steps into a second-floor apartment that faces a busy street in Naples. Beside the door, a discreet name tag reads Associazione Antiracket, the Italian Anti-Extortion Association. Angela is a regular. She comes in for legal advice. The trouble started when Angela was no longer able to run her own cafe because of health problems. Knowing the bank would turn her down, she went to a local man for help. He lent her $10,000 and temporarily ran the cafe. But a few months later, when Angela wanted to go back to work, she found out he had backing from the mafia.
Three men from the Camorra came in and told us how things would go, that we'd have to let one of them run the cafe, that if we didn't do this, they would close it or blow it up.
If she wanted her cafe back, they told her, she'd have to pay $40,000, four times her original loan. In the meantime, the men transformed her business into a literal den of vice.
They used the bar as a cover for all their illegal activities. They sold drugs out of it. It became a clubhouse for all these mobsters.
Un luogo di ritrovo di tutti questi delinquenti.
Questa recessione è una recessione.
Hanno Grasso is the longtime head of the Italian Anti-Racket Association. Until recently, Italian organized crime stayed away from loan sharking. Its cash flow comes from the drug trade and extortion. And crime pays. Italy's four main organized crime groups account for 9% of the country's GDP. Now, with banks no longer lending money to small businesses, Grasso says the mafia sees new opportunity in loan sharking.
E che in questa fase di recessione.
In this phase of the recession, there is only one group that doesn't have a liquidity problem, and that's the mafia. It's a huge opportunity for them to take over businesses. First, to recycle dirty money, and especially to gain control of a new territory.
But anti-mafia activists say it's not all bad news. With the economic squeeze on small businesses, more of them than ever are reporting the mafia. Silvana Fucito was one of the first to finger clan members in court 7 years ago after they burned down her paint store.
There's been a seismic shift. This past year alone, 1,800 small businesses reported the Camorra.
But Fucito says, while it's encouraging the number is up, it's not clear it's because people are feeling braver or fed up with the double pinch of the recession and the mafia. Either way, she says until credit starts to flow from banks, the mafia will use its cash to keep expanding. In Naples, I'm Megan Williams for Marketplace.
Coming up, fruitful trees yield a feast for the needy.
Having the opportunity to distribute 8 or 10,000 pounds of oranges, I mean, it's just a wonderful, wonderful thing.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials bounded 246 points higher today, 3.1%, finished trading at 8,083. The NASDAQ sprang up 61 points, almost 3.9%, ended at 1,652. The S&P 500 zoomed ahead 31 points, 3.8%, closed at 856. For the record, the S&P has now recovered 27%. That's since it sank to a 12-year low exactly 1 month ago today. The Dow up 22% since then. The markets will be closed tomorrow for the Good Friday holiday, so here is the way the week adds up. The Dow rallied 0.8%. The NASDAQ regained 1.9%. The S&P 500 turned in a weekly gain of 1.5%, the fifth straight winning week for all three of the major indices. Oh, yeah, today's Financial Express. Wells Fargo snapped the reins and galloped 31% higher. It seems Bank of America was riding shotgun. Its share stampeded more than 35% higher. And that's enough of the horse metaphors. Bond prices slid. That pushed the yield on the 10-year T-note up to 2.92%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Angie's List, providing firsthand consumer reviews on local services like plumbers, painters, movers, and now doctors. Details at angieslist.com. Keep an eye on Marketplace wherever you go. iPhone users can listen to business news and updates on fallout from the financial crisis, watch the Marketplace whiteboards, and follow the Scratchpad blog. Just visit Marketplace.org on your iPhone.
On the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up tomorrow. In Washington, the Treasury Department releases the monthly budget report for March. Exchange floors are quiet. U.S. markets close in honor of Good Friday. And on April 10th, 1866, the American Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals was founded in New York. I'm Michelle Filippi.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. We have told you the government is trying to entice private capital in to help buy up those troubled assets that are at the root of the financial crisis. And that has been understood so far to be people, or really institutions, with tens of billions of dollars to play around with. But there is word today the little guy might also get a chance to share in the profits, if there are any. The New York Times is reporting that the White House wants big investment firms to create special bailout mutual funds aimed at ordinary investors. We sent Joel Rose out to see who might be interested.
In theory, these funds could give small investors a chance to get the same kind of deal the big guys are getting. Taxpayers cover much of the risk, while investors get to keep most of the profits, if there are any. Sounds like a good idea to paralegal John Coogan, who was eating lunch today at a park in downtown Philadelphia.
Normal mutual funds aren't insured, so to be reimbursed 85% rather than 0% if you lose money, it seems like a good deal to me.
But most mutual funds aren't made out of completely toxic assets.
That's true. So I guess it'll be a gamble. I guess you'd be trading that risk.
If the plan is risky for investors, it's also a roll of the dice for the Obama administration. The White House may be trying to counter the perception that its bailout programs are only aimed at helping Wall Street, not Main Street. But some say the proposed investment bailout funds could backfire.
I think people may buy into it. I'm skeptical whether or not it will work.
Radame Rodriguez works for Comcast. He says private investors could still wind up losing money on the troubled mortgage securities.
What are they worth, and what are they going to be worth? Are you putting your money in a black hole, or is it going to be something that's going to have some return on investment?
That's a question even the most expert investors have had trouble answering, and it gives attorney Frank Rothermel pause.
If you have sophisticated hedge funds that actually haven't lost all their money, that are unwilling to do that deal, my God, why would any, you know, private little guy do that?
Bailout investment funds could be on the market within months, but that doesn't guarantee they'll find many takers. In Philadelphia, I'm Joel Rose for Marketplace.
The Commerce Department reported the February trade deficit this morning. The numbers weren't really surprising. The gap between what we buy from overseas and what we sell abroad narrowed considerably. That's a pretty straight reflection of slack demand in this economy. The politically touchy topic of our trade imbalance with China may be cooling off. The trade deficit there is the closest it's been in more than 3 years. Even though the Chinese economy has slowed too, Beijing has been getting more active and more confident on the international economic stage, most recently at the G20 summit in London. Marketplace's Scott Tong is on the line from Shanghai to tell us more about that. Hey, Scott.
Hello, Kai.
Give us a sense, would you, of the mood over there now that China seems to have reestablished a place here in the global economic sphere.
The term I hear a lot is confident China. It's a term that comes around every once in a while, certainly during the Olympics. And now, it's a very aspirational country. The individuals here are very aspirational. This week, I attended the press conference preview of the Shanghai International Auto Show that happens in a couple weeks. And to many in the industry, this is a giant thing, a passing of the torch, according to one guy in the auto industry, from the importance of the U.S. market to the importance of the China market. Porsche is going to premiere its new models to the world in Shanghai, so is BMW. And the talk was all about China's confidence and China's power. There's a little bit of a swagger, that's the word that one person close to the foreign policy elites in Beijing put it. But in China, it's a subtle thing. It's not the "I just dunked in your face" kind of swagger, but more of a quiet confidence. But you feel it.
But wait a second, though, because by all measures, even though China is hurting, it's still doing pretty well. The World Bank said, listen, China's going to grow economically at 6.5% this year. The rest of the world would kill for those kind of numbers. Why isn't there the more overt, hey, we're doing pretty well and we're proud of it?
I think people in China are careful because it's hard to make the case that China is a rich, rich country. I mean, sure, it's the third biggest economy in the world, but if you think about it, the size of China's economy is basically two Californias. And you divide that by 1.3 billion people, and it's not a very rich country when you think about per person, right next to Albania, in fact, on the world chart. My dad was in town last week, and so we traveled up to Jiangsu province, middle of nowhere, to find my dad's ancestral village. And when you go there, it doesn't conjure up Masters of the Universe. Dirt roads, no indoor plumbing, fairly basic homes. And most people in China live like that. I mean, they don't live in the Disney China that is Shanghai, Kai.
Yeah, I give you the point that the rise to economic power has been and will be gradual. But do you have a sense of what the plan is for China's growing economic power?
I ask that question a lot, and what I often get back is the leadership may not know what the plan is. This is a government that's based on consensus, and they're still trying to get there. So you don't have a clear idea what China wants to do with this growing power. And remember, this place ideologically has been basically bankrupt for 30 years. I mean, the dominant worldview has been market economy and pragmatism. It's not really exporting any giant thoughts to the universe. There's no talk of rewriting the rules at the IMF or the World Trade Organization. You talk to young people and the Marxism class in college is a joke. So it's not a big idea kind of place. And so the world will still be waiting for what does China kind of stand for in this global economy. Now, the question that often gets asked from the U.S., from Washington, is it going to be a threat to the U.S.? I talk about that a lot with my interns and my former interns, but I can't reach them now because they're all in the U.S. in graduate school. So more than a rivalry, it's the young people talk about it, and then they want to go.
Marketplace's Scott Tong in Shanghai for us. Scott, thanks a lot.
All right, Kai. Thank you.
Food pantries across the country are seeing record demand for their services, families looking for help to get by. You pair that with a drop in donations as those who do have try to hang on to what they've got, and some food pantries are worried about being able to meet the need. Marketplace's Caitlin Carroll reports now that instead of giving money, there are some groups out there donating the fruits of their labor.
Hi, guys. Come on up. We're about to do a quick orientation.
A group of about 20 volunteers carrying ladders and baskets surrounds Rick Nemias, the organizer of an afternoon event called the Big Pick. They're gathering on a driveway next to a sprawling house. Behind them is a private grove of orange trees. It'll take just a few hours for these volunteers to harvest thousands of oranges.
This began as a neighborhood project. I'd actually get on my bike and I'd see someone with a tree and I'd stop and talk to him and said, hey, this is what we're doing. Would you be interested in letting us use your tree.
And if they were, Nemias would show up with volunteers and pick the tree clean. The group donates all the fruit to a food pantry with three locations in Los Angeles. The pantry's director of operations, Fred Summers, says this idea couldn't have come at a better time. The pantry's seen demand rise 40% over the last year.
So having the opportunity to, in the next couple of weeks, perhaps distribute 8,000 or 10,000 pounds of oranges, I mean, it's just a wonderful, wonderful thing.
This helps the food pantry cut back its spending on fresh produce. Instead, the money will go toward milk, peanut butter, tuna, other staples. And oranges are packed full of vitamins.
Many of the people that we see who are living on low incomes have very poor diets. Not just that they don't have enough food, but they're eating the wrong foods.
The owners of the trees benefit too. When the fruit doesn't get picked, it rots and attracts coyotes and other critters.
Hello, hello.
Homeowner Grant Goshen greets volunteers before they head out to his small orange grove. Goshen says this is a simple way to give back. And as a banker at UBS, he sees the need every day.
I see it. I live it. I'm seeing the devastation out there, and it's horrendous.
That sentiment is motivating more volunteers as well. Fruit-picking groups from California to New York use online forums like Craigslist, Twitter, and Facebook to find each other. Big Pick volunteer Emily Dell says the idea appealed to her immediately. She can help others, and it's not a bad way to spend an afternoon.
You're up there surrounded by the blossoms, smells beautiful, and the tree kind of is holding you, and you're grabbing the oranges. It's wonderful.
In Los Angeles, I'm Caitlin Carroll for Marketplace.
To see what an orange tree picked clean looks like, you can check out Caitlin's pictures. They're on our website. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing absolute return funds for all kinds of investors. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note today on the perils of live business television. CNBC was covering some remarks by Larry Summers, the head of the National Economic Council, this morning. There were some technical difficulties, so they cut back to anchor Bill Griffith in the studio.
We are, those of you who are listening on radio won't know this, but our picture got a little fidgety there.
That's the way it happened. I'm going to let you make your own joke here about the economy being in the toilet, right? That is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow shot up 246 points, 3.1%. The NASDAQ jumped 61 points, nearly 3.9%. The S&P 500 surged 31 points, 3.8%. Remember, financial markets are closed tomorrow in observance of Good Friday. John Buckley, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, Phyllis Owens, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. Coming up next time, even in the most desirable neighborhoods, prices are coming down.
It's not going to be condos and townhomes for over $1 million because nobody's going to be able to do that these days. It's just not happening.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.